Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. We've just been reading some of your emails. We've had one from Alice, long-time listener Alice,
Yay.
Who we always love it when you get in touch. She says that she's been enjoying the podcast lately, our discussion of Woody Allen plus the Kinks, but I guess that's because I used a Kinks song.
Your music choices in this podcast, I think, are kind of unsung, but fantastic.
I'm so glad. Thank you for the praise. She wanted to recommend Transparent to us, which I have watched like one episode maybe of the first season way back when and then not re-engaged with, and it's clearly something that I should be engaging with.
Yeah, same. I've heard such good things and it's been on the kind of fictitious list in my head of things to watch and have not got around to it, so yeah, I need to.
Terrible from us, but we will definitely get on it at some point. She also says that she really enjoyed The Lesser Bohemians. It was like nothing I'd ever read before, so thank you for that recommendation. Our little book club of 18-year-olds loved it, haha. Which just warms my heart so
much. I love hearing about Alice's book group, Seriously book group that they get to. I think it's in Glasgow they are, aren't they?
Yeah,
they get together.
So.
I'm really glad you enjoyed that. Yeah. And we're hoping to do some more books in the future, really, aren't we?
Yeah. We're hoping to sort of knuckle down on some reading because I think it's a great way for you guys to join in with us and read alongside us. And yeah, it's just fun.
Let us know if you have any thoughts about particularly like upcoming books you want to hear us talk about. And we're going to try and sort of plan a bit ahead and maybe post what book we're going to do so you can maybe try and get it in advance, all that kind of stuff.
She also said she hopes we both feel better soon. And I think we do, don't we?
Yeah, I think so. I'm definitely less full of cold than I was a week ago.
I'm sure it was really like audible in the podcast.
Yeah, not just croaky voice, but also just sadness with life. So the first thing we're going to talk about this week is Amanda Knox, a 2016 Netflix documentary by debut filmmakers Rod Blackhurst and Brian McGinn. It follows the events of the 2007 Meredith Kercher murder case in Perugia, Italy, for which Amanda Knox was convicted and then finally cleared last year.
Did you kill Meredith Kercher?
No.
Were you there that night?
No.
Do you know anything you have not told police?
No.
That's everyone's nightmare. Either I'm a psychopath in sheep's clothing, or I am you.
This was obviously such a huge deal, and I really feel like I wasn't very engaged with it at the time. It's the kind of thing that now I think I would follow quite, you know, morbidly.
Mm.
But at the time, I think maybe because when it actually happened, I was still at school and probably just not actually reading the news in that way.
Yeah, I was at university and it kind of impacted me in a very specific way, which was I remember there being extra talks about campus safety for people who were doing study abroad.
Right.
Because Knox and Kircher were both in Perugia on like Erasmus or, you know, equivalent sort of year out of university study at foreign university schemes. And there were people in my year who were going to do that. But yeah, that was my only real knowledge of it. Like, I didn't read the Daily Mail, which, judging by this documentary, had like a Foxy Knoxy front page every day for a year.
Yeah,
at least.
Exactly. So coming to this documentary, the first thing that I was really struck by immediately was like, whoa, the access here immediately feels uncomfortable. Almost in the opening 3 seconds, we get like footage from inside the murder scene from very soon after Meredith's body was discovered. I didn't love as a more general point, which I'm sure we'll come back to, like the way Meredith is kind of treated in this documentary. Obviously, it's called Amanda Knox. She's not actually the focus of it. But in those first 3 seconds, you like see shots of her foot like repeatedly. And I don't feel like they're justified by much conversation about her. Do you know what I mean? If there was a lot of discussion of her as a person, then you could see those shots without feeling like she was completely dehumanized.
Apparently, that more generally was a deliberate choice by her family. I was reading about some of the reaction to the documentary and the case more generally. They're saying that her family has always really guarded what they see as her privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So they haven't released lots of photographs of her looking happy when she was alive. They haven't released really much personal information about her because they felt like even though she's dead, no one has any right to know her apart from us.
Mm.
So I think in the absence of lots of like Facebook photos to flash up of her, she either disappears slightly from the story or they had to use the police footage, which is unfortunately grisly.
I think it's one of these problems with all true crime stuff, which is no matter how you look at it, that victim is getting exploited in some way, whether she's kept at a dignified distance, which can look dismissive, or whether you sort of rake over old photos, which can feel really horrible and intrusive. So it's this weird, it feels really uncomfortable, right?
Yeah, and her family didn't participate in the documentary either.
They're in it, but I guess that's footage from other stuff.
It's like footage from press conferences years ago and stuff like that. And mostly it's just edited down to them saying, like, in reaction to a verdict, you know, we're glad that justice has been done at last. That kind of statement.
I just was really struck by how much we're like encouraged to throw ourselves into the details of this like horrible thing. And I don't know why it struck me more than other things that I've watched this year and in previous years, but for some reason it just did.
Yeah, well, something that struck me about it is that, so this case was in 2007, so it was already, I think, in a roughly similar media landscape to the one we live in now. Like, the main journalist that they interview throughout, he talks about people blogging and uploading stories during the case and that kind of thing. So it wasn't like it happened in a print-only media culture.
Mm.
But at the same time, it happened in a pre-true crime boom era. So I felt like I was getting a weird kind of retconned Making a Murderer style approach to a case that happened before that style of telling true crime stories existed.
Yeah, I guess the thing with this stuff is like people have always just been so keen on being like, oh, I know who really did this. Like, that's such a human impulse. And like, even the main detective in this program is like, I loved Sherlock Holmes. And then later you see him like literally smoking a pipe.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
What the fuck is this weird fan fiction like life that's going on with this man? And like, that is such a base impulse that so many of us have. I want to know whether Amanda did it. I think I can tell by looking in her eyes, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that continues, you know, in all the stuff that we see today and in this documentary.
The fact that her conviction was overturned based on DNA evidence as well, like,
basically this is similar to the Making a Murderer stuff. So they found Amanda's DNA on a knife handle and Meredith's DNA on a knife blade, and that was really instrumental in their original conviction. They realized later on that those traces were so small and the crime scene was handled so terribly that it could just literally have been
contamination in the lab or anything. So on that basis, her appeal was upheld, and I think it went all the way to Italy Supreme Court last year, and the appeal was still upheld, so I don't think she can be tried again for it.
Yeah, and without that knife, there's no DNA of hers in the murder scene at all,
and
anywhere.
No witness statement that puts her at the flat at the time or anything like that.
So regardless of whether or not she did it, the evidence isn't there, right? And that's basically how a lot of people feel about Stephen Avery.
Yes.
It's like so much of the handling of evidence was fucked up that even if he did do it, they just don't have enough evidence to really convict him in a fair manner. And that's why people are so outraged about his case, right?
If you start convicting people based on feelings, or as you say, looks in eyes, then the whole system is arbitrary and pointless anyway. So whether you believe something to be true or not, if you cannot show it to be true.
Mm-hmm. So this dragged up so much stuff for me from Janet Malcolm's amazing book, The Journalist and the Murderer, which everyone should read because it's so great. And it's a lot of it is about like the ethics of crime journalism, basically. And I thought about it a lot when Making of a Murderer happened, but I thought about it even more in this relation to this documentary, because bizarrely, the person who comes off worst in this whole documentary is not like a potential murderer or a shitty policeman. It's a journalist called Nick Pisa, who writes for the Daily Mail, and he comes across absolutely terribly. He's like the worst, right?
If they had cast someone to play a like evil grubbing journalist in a film, you would cast this guy?
Yeah, he's so shockingly inappropriate at all times. Really early on, he's like really boasting about all the front pages he got out of Foxy Noxy, and like how scandalous it was and how attractive both the girls were and how cool it was that it was potentially like a sex orgy murder. At no point does he seem to say like, my sympathies are with the victim's family or anything. And then at one point he's literally like, you know, I can only compare the high of getting these bylines with like having sex. And you're like, really? You really think that's the appropriate like comparison in this horrific instance?
So he is horrific, absolutely. But in some ways, of course I didn't admire him, but I found his honesty,
refreshing.
His horrible honesty, quite refreshing. Because I think the public, the newspaper reading public, likes to lie to itself about why it's reading about this kind of thing, right?
Absolutely.
You know, they were because it's a, you know, it's a really important news story and it's very tragic. That's why I'm reading page after page of stuff about Foxy Noxy's alleged voodoo killing. Whereas he's like, there were two attractive women involved. Amanda had this kind of manner about her that made her seem difficult. There was this kind of shadowy unknown in the background. Oh, and the kind of supposedly like ritualistic sex-fueled nature of the killing titillated people as well. Of course it just ran and ran and ran, you know. So he was just really upfront about that, in a way that is sort of refreshing. I mean, I've heard people say this about the Madeleine McCann story as well, that like just everything about that story ticked every single tabloid newspaper box. If the girl had happened to have brown hair, it would not be
the Madeleine McCann story
it is today. It's just when all of those weird, like, voyeuristic factors collide. Of course, it was a horrible thing to happen to Meredith Kircher's family, etc., etc., but horrible things happen to people every day. So to try and analyse why one horrible thing becomes
infamous and another
doesn't is interesting.
I think, it's definitely true that people lie to themselves about why they read these stories. And it was funny to me that Nick Pisa was like, you know, everyone complains about how horrible and sensationalized the stories were, but you know, they were the same people who were reading it, which is true. But I find it funny that he uses that as a sort of defense, because it's sort of like people are telling you that although they will read this, they sort of wish that they couldn't.
Yeah.
And so that's when you have to step in and be like, okay, at what point do I stop covering this story? Or at what point do I cover it more sensitively? Or at what point do I, for example, double check my facts? Which was a very weird part where he was like, I'm not expected to do that.
Yeah, where he was like, well, you know, I'm just reporting what people are telling me. I mean, I can't, you know, check it all. And it's like, no, you can. That's literally your job.
That's the foundation, is that you have to like double check your sources. You have to have more than one source coming to you with a story.
Like, I did not know, for instance, that they published Amanda Knox's like prison diary that was presumably leaked by a guard, I think.
Awful.
Someone like stole it from her cell and leaked it. As horrible as I think that is, you know, if he's going to publish it as Amanda Knox's diary, he has to verify that it is Amanda Knox's diary, right? And in the same way that if a colleague of hers from the bar she worked at told her some things about Amanda, you have to check that they actually knew her.
Yeah.
Basic stuff like that at the minimum. But yeah, he didn't seem to think that was part of his job.
No, but so really bizarre. I'm not sure about how she comes off in the documentary, because I don't know much about the story. I was watching it with my boyfriend, and before we went in he was like, 100% she was involved, like no way is she 100% innocent. I didn't feel that way watching this, but I also found it at times overly sympathetic towards her, because she's front and center in this documentary. She's got like time speaking to the camera, tearing up, telling everyone how difficult it was for her and how horrible it was for her family and how she contemplated suicide and all of this stuff. It's very hard to watch that and not feel something for her, right?
Yeah, well, the whole documentary has essentially been built around her. So these two guys who made the film are newcomers in documentary terms. They've only made shorts before this, and they had a mutual friend with Amanda Knox from Seattle, and they approached her via the friend and was like, we'd like to make a film about you, will you be in it? And they were astonished when she was like, yes. And then they went out and got everyone else. So they didn't, she was the first person they got on board with it. Then they went and got, you know, her ex-boyfriend, Rafael Solito. They went and got the Italian prosecutor. Everyone else who speaks on it was like secondary to Amanda Knox. And that is how it comes across. It is structured in that way.
Definitely.
And it is obviously the selling point. In a case that's been covered every which way, you have to have your selling point as your new contribution, and theirs is, we've got Amanda Knox herself.
Exactly. And it's funny because you start interrogating these things from an ethical standpoint and you say, well, is it ethical to just present her story? Mm. And then there's other voices. So you're like, okay, but is it ethical to present all these voices but really make her the focus and therefore the like sympathetic voice of the documentary? And then you're like, well, nothing's neutral. No one's going to make a neutral documentary about this.
Yeah.
That's impossible. Evidence isn't neutral. So is it ethical to make one at all? And then you like get into this whole pit of there's no going back once you start to pick at these things, right?
Yeah. And I have to say, although aware that I was getting maybe a more sympathetic line on her than I would elsewhere, I did feel like by the end that the court's decision is the right one.
Yeah, so did I, but not necessarily because I'm like, yeah, of course she's completely innocent and she wasn't involved. There's some weird stuff going on there, but there's no DNA evidence. There's no proper proof that you can be like, yes, she was definitely there and she was definitely involved in some way. So you just cannot, I mean, there's no more to say.
Yeah.
Once the police have fucked something up to that extent, you just have to be like, well, sorry, now she gets to walk free because you fucked up the case. Like, yeah. Whether she did it or not, we'll never know, but you cannot prosecute someone once you've done all this shit. So an interesting watch, if a slightly ethically tricky one.
Yeah, definitely one that makes you think rather than one that makes you happy to watch, so let's say.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So the next thing we're going to talk about is A Seat at the Table, the third studio album from Solange Knowles. It features 21 tracks and 8 collaborations, including with the rapper Lil Wayne and Kelly Rowland. Exploring issues of racism and psychological trauma, in Solange's own words, the album is a journey of healing, self-reflection, self-discovery, and empowerment. I've spent the weekend listening to it, as I think a lot of people around the world did, and I found it such a soothing listen. I think she really translates that idea of healing really, really well, because it feels like someone just telling you that it's going to be okay.
Yeah, I actually can't wait to take a long train journey with this album. I feel like it's going to be perfect for
yeah
that.
Definitely. I just had it on while I was pottering around my room and thinking about my life, and it was great.
Yeah, it's very smooth. It's got a slightly early R&B feel to it in some places, which I really like. It's quite unified as a piece of music.
It's thematically and sonically like consistent, isn't it, without ever being boring. Like,
no,
it's
absolutely, but it feels like every song takes something musically from the previous one and builds on it rather than being contrasting, which is is also a valid way of making an album, to make like a group of contrasting songs. But this is very much like, in my classical terms, I would think of it as like movements of a symphony. So like one united piece.
Lovely. There are some elements of this album that I can't fully appreciate because it's another one of these things that speaks out of and to Black experience. Mm. And I guess that's really present in the title as well, a seat at the table, like who gets a seat at the table, etc. Yeah.
And the fact that there's a song called Don't Touch My Hair.
Yeah. Obviously, there are some songs on this album that I would never sing along to because of, you know, the N-word and so on. So there's an element of this album that's never going to be fully for me, but I still find it such an amazing listen and so immersive, in the same way that something like Lemonade is a really immersive listen, or in the same way that I found Claudia Rankine's Citizen so powerful, which apparently was actually one of the influences for album.
That makes sense.
It does, doesn't it? I feel like you can really feel that thing. It's so easy to say this about lyrics, but there is something quite poetic in Solange's lyrics, and like even on Rise, they're so simple, those lyrics on Rise, and you know, just taking like a phrase and then changing it ever so slightly each line, but it really, really works. And it also works when you're thinking about racism in terms of like micro and macro, how little things, and then you zoom out and you see a bigger picture and things like that. So it's just really, really amazing. And I think it does sort of sit well alongside Lemonade as well, although they're very, very different in terms of the kinds of music. I think you can tell that they sort of come from the same household.
Yeah, you can. I think you can. The other thing that it made me think was Frank Ocean's Blonde, both in terms of subject matter and also some of the musical style.
They're both
as well
so laid back in that you could imagine, like, I don't know, I feel like you could imagine listening to them like three gin and tonics in on a holiday.
Yeah.
But you could also listen to them like when you're trying to get something done in your room. Like there's that real relaxedness of it. It's very versatile.
Yeah, and I love now that we're at a place with music where a blockbuster release, which Blonde and A Seat at the Table both have been, can be conceptual and laid back at the same time. Because as much as I love Lemonade, it is like pow, a punch in the face. Like it's full of immensely catchy pop tunes as well as more reflective, quieter things. So it's easy to see how it comes from like a long line of big hit albums that have really hit people hard to start with, whereas both A Seat at the Table and Blonde grow on you. They're a bit more difficult, they're a bit more elusive, and yet millions of people download them immediately and start thinking about them.
Yeah,
and I really
so
love that.
Cool. It is really cool, and it's so amazing how many, I feel like, artists like Solange and Frank Ocean maybe didn't get the appreciation they deserved when their debuts came out, and have sort of been more slow burn, almost cult fandoms that have just become more and more mainstream. And it's really nice to see how much love there is out there for this album. Like the coverage of it has been amazing, which is obviously so deserved, but just great to see. And I know that she was tweeting like, oh, I'm so overwhelmed with gratitude and stuff, and that's amazing. I've really enjoyed a lot of the coverage of this album as well. Like there was a great interview that Tavi Gevinson
that was really
did,
good,
and obviously Tavi forever, but really, really cool.
I have to say, I don't know much about the rest of Solange's music. My main engagement with her prior to this was being obsessed with the photos of her wedding.
And it's so funny because, have you seen the visuals have come out for a couple of them? And it's art directed, or directed even, sorry if I've got that slightly wrong, but the art direction is from her and her husband. And it does have that a similar feel to their wedding photos, which obviously are a huge deal. If you're like a really creative couple and you're getting married, you are going to like basically art direct your wedding photos.
Yeah,
you can see that in some of the shots in her videos for, is it for Cranes in the Sky?
Yes, very much.
And
all those people just like sat on the steps or like looking at the camera. Yeah,
it's wonderful. And I love how fashion in all of Solange's music videos and just like in her general life becomes like a serious part of it. And it's fun and playful, and it's not a case of being like, yes, fashion is always super, super political, but it is never dismissive, and it is a way of like working that aesthetic into stuff in a meaningful way. And there's like this amazing gold dress that she's wearing that's like sort of fringy almost in the video that her mum made. And I just love the way that she handles all these things. Like I think she's got such a great sense of like tradition, and especially like women and Black women handing things down to each other, that really makes everything she makes seem so made with love. And I think that's so cool.
I mean, all round, I'm excited to get to know her better, actually, like as an artist. I hope she's gonna do more.
I mean, this took her 4 years, and I think every day of those 4 years comes through in the album. So congrats, Solange, from us.
As much as that matters. Yeah.
Yeah.
So last week I recommended via a friend. It would be uncharitable of me to claim this as my own. It was definitely a friend's recommendation. I recommended that Caroline watch The Bletchley Circle, which is, to my understanding, a murder mystery style program featuring Anna Maxwell Martin as an ex-code breaker who is using her talents in a more detective-y way. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, basically the four central characters are all women who worked in code breaking at Bletchley Park during the Second World War.
Together, as in they know each other?
Yes, they were like a little team.
Cute.
And they all have like a special ability.
Is this made by Marvel?
Actually, one of them does have like comic book worthy, but it is a totally human realistic. And she's just got one of those completely photographic memories where she like remembers everything she's ever looked at or read and can access all information in her head. So yeah, Lucy, the one character has that. And then Anna Maxwell Martin's character is really good at like seeing patterns. Another one is really good at research and thinking laterally. No surprise at all that in her post-war life, she's become a librarian and archivist, you know. So they've all gone on into civilian life, not able to tell anybody, of course, because they all had to sign the Official Secrets Act. So Anna Maxwell Martin's character hasn't even told her own husband what she did during the war. He just thinks she was like
extreme.
A clerk in a government department or something. So she's the one who kicks it all off. She hears the radio reporting of this series of really horrible murders of women in and around London. And she thinks there's a pattern here that the police haven't picked up on. Like, her initial instinct is they've missed one. The series of murders, there's one missing in this pattern. So she basically gets the gang back together.
Love it!
And they look into it. And actually, I have to say, having seen some of the pictures of this before it was recommended, I was not expecting it to be as dark as it is.
Is it macabre?
Yeah, the crime that they're investigating is horrible.
Oh my god, that makes me want to watch it more.
Yeah, I think it's a really brave decision the writers of this made, actually, because you've got a kind of slightly cuddly tea time aspect to it. Oh, Second World War, or women wearing post-war clothing, you know, that kind of thing. But actually, it's about a man who like abducts women, kills them in basements, and then rapes them. You know, it's really horrible. So yeah, it's got a really kind of dark undertone, and there's some genuine like peril in it as well. I got quite alarmed.
Not mild peril.
No,
real peril.
Actual peril when like they get a bit too practical in their investigations, and like one of the women, she basically poses as the type of girl they think the man wants on a train.
Oh, this is such a classic murder mystery.
Yeah, it's really quite stressful. So yeah, I've been completely obsessed with it in the last week.
I was going to say, from the way you're talking about it, I assume your reaction has been good.
Yeah, it's basically what I've been thinking about.
Oh, great. It's what a great recommendation. I'm so sad I didn't come up with it, because it fits your sort of TV watching profile, I think, extremely well.
And I'm already preemptively sad. So, you know, I'm still in the first series of, there's three episodes of series, and I know there's only one more series. I don't think they made any more after the second series.
That's so sad.
So I think, like my love for cancelled BBC show The Hour, I think it's
going to intensify.
It's going to be intense but brief.
Oh, well, I'm so glad you liked it. So thanks to my mate Harriet.
And for next week, I'm going to recommend you a fantastic film from 1985 that I've only recently become aware of, called The Sure Thing.
The Sure Thing.
The Sure Thing, which is a romantic comedy directed by Rob Reiner, who did When Harry Met Sally.
Mm-hmm.
And it stars a very young, fresh-faced John Cusack as, I think, Gib. I haven't watched it for ages, but Gib, his name is. And he is like a college student, and he has this kind of prickly female antagonist, you know, how this works. And I'm not some
antagonist.
And basically, they end up on this road trip for Christmas break or something to get to California, where he's been promised a, quote, sure thing of, like, you know, his friend's older sister or something who's, like, really hot and totally up for anything.
So the sure thing is a sex sure
thing.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
And her very staid, sensible boyfriend is also in California. So they're, like, united in their purpose to get across America in the snow.
For sex.
For sex, essentially.
They're a sex road trip together.
Yeah, and they have...
I think we know where this is going.
They have, like, various adventures and, you know, spoiler alert, come to think differently of each other.
Okay, great. That sounds like it ticks all my boxes, like ka-ching, rom-com, ta-ting, college, tense sex vibes in a car. I'm up for it. Sounds great.
Also, the clothes are fantastic.
Perfect.
It's kind of like Cher from Clueless, but like 5 years earlier.
Oh, yes, please. I get the feeling it's like a wintry college vibe.
Very much so. So they go to like an East Coast school, but they're nice. Like from California.
I hope there's some plaid and some hats.
Oh, she wears some very, very good plaid skirts.
Great. I can't wait. Thank you, Caroline.
Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Seriously. All you have to do is search SRSLY in iTunes or any other podcasting app you use. While you're there, it would be really great if you could leave us an iTunes review, as it helps other people find the show.
We also rely on you listeners for your recommendations, so if you want to tell us what you thought about something, or if you've got something we should watch, you can contact us on Twitter, Facebook, via email. All the details are on seriouslypodcast.com. If you like, you can also recommend us to your friends, family, neighbours, strangers. Let them know that you like the podcast and they should be listening to it too.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.